You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey, please drink responsibly.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stugatz Podcast.
Breakfast is a 1960s Mad Men era marketing scheme by Kellogg's and Big Cereal to sell sugary snacks to little kids and moms for breakfast every morning. I am not buying that it is the most cereal. Important meal of the day.
Great
that is
take.
Not true.
Wow, hot take right there.
I think that's actually true. I think that Big Cereal has put out, and like even like the five big major cereal. Food groups and like all like the food pyramid, it's antiquated and wrong and was created by industry. Jessica's 100% right.
I know I'm right. I didn't make it up. It's true. Breakfast is not as important as it's not the most important meal of the day. You don't need it.
She wasn't
What's
looking
the
for
most
your,
important meal of the day.
She wasn't looking for your verification, Whittingham.
Yeah.
I don't think there is a most important meal of the day. I think you just feed yourself when you're hungry.
No.
And that's, no. You know, keep yourself sharp, give yourself fuel throughout the day and you're good.
No. Around the room right now, everybody's meal power rankings.
Breakfast is last for me, and a really good breakfast. This is Mike Greenberg, a really good breakfast. He's not saying that it's the significant breakfast. He's saying it is without question. There is no question here. It is without question the best and most satisfying meal. And then if you don't agree, he doesn't know what to tell you. After that, he's got the strong opinion on the front end. But if you don't agree, he's simply at a loss and he has no opinion. He doesn't know what to tell you. $6 million a year.
If you overeat at breakfast, though, your entire day is ruined. Same goes for brunch. That is why I think brunch is a dangerous concept, because you can go to a brunch, eat one extra pancake too many or one extra mimosa too much, and then you're just asleep the rest of the day, and the day is ruined. And that is why it's not the most important meal of the day.
Guillermo, put it on the poll, please. Dangerous game, brunch, yes or no, at Le Batard Show.
One of the most dangerous of games. Really what brunch does, Dan, and Jessica is right, it has the potential to throw your entire day off. Perhaps your week. I mean, really, because you eat at 11, and then all of a sudden you're eating again at 3:30 if you're up, if you're not drunk, if you're not hammered. I'm telling you, it's a very dangerous game. In fact, as far as food goes, I would say brunch is probably the most dangerous of the food games.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
No, late night Taco Bell.
I'm with you.
Ooh, late night Taco Bell is a good submission, Chris.
Wow. Wow, that's dangerous.
Let's put them against each other. Versus at Le Batard Show, most dangerous game in terms of what? Ruining your day, your sleep, your stomach? How are we
your
doing
life.
This?
Your ruining life. Ruining life.
In terms the most of, dangerous of food
in
games.
In terms of, ruining your life. Taco Bell, late at night, post 2 a.m. or brunch.
Okay. I'd also like to submit as a third nominee a Brazilian churrasqueria, where you have where you get the steak, it's green card, red card.
For days. I mean
you, that is food coma
meat,
city.
Meat coma.
Wow.
Meat coma.
I started sweating after you said that.
The meat sweats are unpleasant. All right, let's ask this dangerous, you'd say dangerous games, and I present to you a guy who made Jessica sick with this film that he made, because what he does is so crazy. He is now dissecting it in a 10-part podcast series, Climbing Gold. It's available wherever you get your podcasts, and we were discussing how you pronounce his name. So, Jessica, did you come to a conclusion on how we are correctly pronouncing his name? Because before we get to his dangerous game, and this movie was exceptional, Stugatz. It was horrifying what he does for a living. And I also thought while I was watching it, and I don't know what's happened to his relationship since, but he was climbing mountains dangerously, and the woman of his dreams was trying to conquer the mountain that was him and his commitment to this sport. And so I thought the documentary was actually his friends telling him to not get married by making the documentary. And I don't know what has happened to that relationship since or how he experienced all that, but I found the film fascinating.
You're
from
throwing
that perspective.
A lot at our guest right now.
I am. Yes, yes. But that, I saw the movie and it was amazing. And Jessica, you were just simply terrified of the movie, correct?
Yeah, after the first 5 minutes of the movie, I literally Googled, is Alex Honnold still alive? Because I was like, I cannot watch the rest of this movie if he is going to die at the end. And that was the stakes of this film. And I think, Alex, you probably knew this going into making this film, that was a potential outcome. And the filmmakers were aware of that, and it made the stakes probably higher than any other documentary I've ever seen.
Welcome, Alex, to the show and the awkwardness around this entire conversation. I found it fascinating. You're getting this reaction from a lot of people, right? You really let people into every crevice of your life in a way that left you vulnerable but was super fascinating. And thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no, thanks. I feel like I just jumped right into the middle of something very exciting here. You guys are just going off.
Just brunch.
So what is the most dangerous game? Is it brunch carbs? Is it 2 a.m. Taco Bell? Or is it the other submission here that the Brazilian steakhouse churrasqueria, no limits on the meat you can consume?
I think the churrasqueria is probably the yeah. most dangerous game.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow. That's coming from the authority on dangerous games.
Yeah.
I wanted to probe your psyche a little bit because I feel like everyone is doing that with your psyche. I don't know. How would you explain to a stranger your fascination and the obsessive compulsive zeal that it takes to climb mountains the way you do, the most dangerous way that you could possibly do testing of fate, where you're doing it without a lot of help, a lot of support, physical support, and you're doing something that has killed your friends?
Well, okay, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but so it hasn't actually killed that many of my friends, not that many people. Like, so in the film Free Solo, and it says that most high-end free soloists have died, most of them have actually died in accidents unrelated to free soloing, like in other aspects of climbing, so like in rappelling accidents or base jumping accidents or things like that. And so, you know, I think one of the lessons from that is that if you're going to be free soloing, make sure that you're paying attention when you do it. You know, do it with intention. Like, be smart about the risks that you're taking. And so the thing with what I'm doing, and the thing that I think is hard to convey in a 90-minute documentary, is that I've been climbing full-time for 25 years. And, you know, some of the goal of free soloing El Cap is something I worked on for 8 years. I mean, the film shows me working on it for 2 years. And then the climb is ultimately like a 4-hour, you know, sort of beautiful experience at the end of 2 years of effort. And so I think to look at that and say like, oh, you know, it's so crazy, it's so much risk-taking, it's so dangerous. You're like, well, you know, I mean, after 25 years of effort and 2 years of direct training to do a specific climb for 4 hours, it's like, yes, that climb seems, you know, might look crazy, but there's a pretty solid context there.
Can you explain to us the nature of the obsession? Like, seeing you after you had conquered the mountain, and forgive me for not remembering the particulars, but you basically scaled an unscalable mountain with no rope support in about 50 minutes. And it was the quest of the entire movie, and you did it really fast and it seemed super dangerous. And then you're in the van later and you're still doing the finger push-ups to strengthen your fingers. Can you sort of explain to us the obsessive compulsiveness that this requires to be great at it the way you are?
What? So I wouldn't call it obsessive compulsive. I'd call it consistency. You know, it's like I love rock climbing. I love going out and pushing myself as a climber. You know, I mean, I love the day to day. I love spending time on the cliff. I mean, so, you know, me free soloing El Cap, it's in Yosemite National Park. It's one of the most beautiful places on earth. So every day that I'm out training and practicing and spending my time working on a climb, I'm also in one of the most beautiful places on earth, looking around, taking in the view, enjoying the whole experience. So, you know, I mean, I've always loved climbing. And if I'm going to spend all my time doing it, I want to do it as well as I can. And that sort of requires, you know, the training, the extra things like what you're talking about, the hangboarding at the end, you know, the fingertip pull-ups. It's like, if I'm going to spend all my time doing it, I want to do it as well as I can.
Is there an instruction here or a life lesson? I don't know how spiritual you are in the meditative practice of being that present, of being the kind of present that you're talking about, which is not just enjoying the beauty of the moments, but you're doing something that is life and death, and it requires at every instance an uncommon focus.
Yeah, that's true. So I'm not spiritual at all. I'm not religious. And I've, you know, I don't really practice meditation or anything like that. But I think that with free soloing, I think part of what I enjoy about free soloing so much is that it requires you to be totally in the present and totally focused on what you're doing. And so I think that through something like free soloing, I can kind of have a meditative experience without actually knowing how to meditate, you know, because I think to have transcendent experiences through meditation requires a tremendous amount of you know, mental training, basically. And that's really hard for anybody. But, you know, I've sort of been able to tap into some small feeling of that through climbing. And I love climbing. And so, you know, it's kind of the better way for me to get there.
Well, when you explain that, though, is there a better feeling that the pursuit gives you than that one? When you say it's one of the reasons that I do it, like, what are the others?
Well, I mean, there's also the opportunity to be the first to do something that's ever been done, you know, to like do something historic in a sport. You know, it's like as a 25 year practitioner of climbing, you know, I'm deeply into it. I care about the history. I care about the people. Like that matters to me. I mean, I'm also a professional climber. I'm sponsored. I make a living through it. So it's like there is the recognition that by making a good film, it's easier for me to make a living, things like that. You know, I mean, of course, there are all these other factors to why I want to climb difficult things. But I think at the core of it is the fact that it's really fun. You know, it's really quite a joy to climb walls like that.
Climbing Gold, the 10-part podcast series, what are you doing that for? Obviously, climbers are going to be attracted to it at every turn. But when you say the documentary wasn't enough to capture it, it was pretty comprehensive. It was thorough in explaining difficult subject matter. You wanted people to understand this more. Why do the podcast series as an elaboration?
Yeah, so Climbing Gold is actually, you may not know that climbing is in the Olympics for the first time this summer. And so we felt like it's a very particular moment for climbing in that the sport has been growing tremendously and the opportunity for people to go climbing through indoor climbing gyms now is greater than it's ever been. So there are basically more and more people joining the sport and the sport's going more mainstream. But we felt like there's some real gems, like basically some really great climbing stories that help sort of bridge climbing culture, climbing history. You know, like I said, I've been doing it a long time and it means a lot to me. And so I wanted to make sure that there's a body of knowledge available for anybody who's getting into the sport now. And so Climbing Gold is actually made more for sort of recreational climbers or even non-climbers because it's designed to be sort of this comprehensive, not just history, but like history told through the best stories, you know, like those little golden nuggets where you're like, oh, that was so crazy. I can't believe he did that. But things coming from the people who founded different aspects of the sport, basically.
Alex, you make it seem easy because you're great at it. And I understand that. And so when you're doing it, you're probably very comfortable. But I'm wondering, have you been terrified? Is there ever a time where you're up there and you're thinking, man, this might be it for me?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, you can't get relaxed in those situations without having tons and tons of situations that are very character building. I mean, so many experiences like that I couldn't even list. You know, and ranging from the relatively mundane where it's like I'm not actually in that much danger, but my mind is getting away from me and I just feel really scared, to the other end of the spectrum where you're actually in a tremendous amount of danger, but your mind is crystal clear and you're like, okay, like here's what I need to do to survive. But I mean, you know, if you're going out and climbing in the mountains day in and day out, it's like, yeah, you're having tons of scary experiences.
What is your relationship with fear?
Well, I mean, it's complicated. You know, I mean, I don't like being afraid any more than anybody else, but I think that I've been afraid in these circumstances so much more than average that I'm probably better at handling it than the average person. I mean, I would assume I would assume that most of you guys in day-to-day life don't ever think that you're about to die, you know? No. So I think that when you're doing things in the mountains where you have to face that fairly frequently, you just get a lot better at being able to handle it.
Every time I park in this garage, other than that, though, I mean, we're good.
Yes.
Honestly, that is kind of true. I mean, cities like I walk around New York City or something, I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to get hit by a car for sure. It's like slightly the same kind of fear, you know?
It's really more the smell from my garage, the disease and, you know, everything else.
What is the part of what you do that you'd like people to understand or is most misunderstood?
Oh, I think that what people might not appreciate enough is how much I love the sensation of it, like how fun it is to climb a wall like that, because everybody focuses on the fear, the death, you know, basically everyone focuses on the downside of it, but nobody really focuses on the upside, which is that you get to walk up to a wall that looks impossible and then climb it with your bare hands. It's so cool. I mean, it's just, and to feel confident walking into any kind of mountain range and know that you could scramble up and over a peak if you want to, you know, it's like there's a ton of freedom of movement and it just allows you to go to all these incredible places.
Your hands are like feet, right? Or your feet are like hands. What are some of the things that you can do with that your hands that simply the rest of us couldn't possibly understand?
Oh, I don't think it's anything crazy, but I mean, I've spent a long time basically working out my fingers. So my forearms are stronger than average, obviously. So I can hang from, you know, a small edge with a hand, things like that. But it's nothing crazy.
It seems like it would have to be though, right? It would seem that your hands and feet would have to work as better as tools than the rest of us could possibly imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I probably use my hands more like tools than most, but you know, you could Google a video of somebody playing the piano with their toes and you're like, whoa, it just shows that anything you practice enough, you get pretty good at.
What would you regard as the most uncomfortable situation you've had to be in on the side of a mountain?
Like, honestly, we could chat all day about it. I don't even know. I mean, there have been a handful of things like in southern Argentina and Patagonia, a friend and I, actually, I think, maybe a photo of it on the wall behind me, but a friend and I were trying to traverse this series of granite spires and a storm came in and we basically got thwarted sort of like near the end of one of the spires, and we decided to escape the mountain off the other side, which is like a 4,000 foot ice wall basically, and then one of our ropes got mildly cut, and so we were basically rappelling this 4,000 foot ice wall in a storm with a rope that had like a hole in it basically, and you know, it's pretty scary for a really long period of time, but it is very much a survival situation because you're in a storm and you're sort of like, all right, now. And then once we got down, we were on the wrong side of the mountain range because we'd escaped off the other side. But then we had to walk all the way around a mountain range to get back to town. So it wound up being a 20-hour walk without food at the end of a 54-hour push. So we basically exercised for 54 hours straight with a 20-hour walk at the end.
So is there something about you that craves the mental tests, that the tests of your mental strength?
Well, to be fair, in that specific situation, after we got back to town, I changed my plane ticket and went home. I was like, well, that worked. It's like, that's the end of the season. You know, it's like, and we lost all our equipment along the way and the ropes were destroyed. And the storm was so severe that the camp that we had started from all got blown away, like basically went to the ocean. So we had no more tent or sleeping bag or anything like that. So I was like, well, that's the end of the trip. So it's not exactly like I crave situations like that, because obviously we were doing our best to minimize them. In that case, the storm just sort of arrived early and we hadn't managed to finish the climb in time. But it's not that I'm seeking those experiences out, but I do think that by having them, it sort of enriches the rest of my life to some extent.
Is there anything worse for you than a deceptively small crevice?
I don't know what that means exactly, but... I feel like there's a lot of innuendo in that or something, but
No. Listen, just a couple of climbers talking about climbing.
Cutting it up. A couple of climbers. He's just, I don't think he was being double entendre there. I think he was just asking you about how exasperating it must be to come upon a deceptively small crevice.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I have pretty fat fingers, so really small cracks are a personal challenge. And, you know, there is nothing worse than climbing a feature and having it sort of peter out into nothingness. And then all of a sudden you're like left in no man's land being like, oh, no, there's nothing more to climb. But typically, you know, you have a little map or something. You have a plan. You know, you can avoid that kind of thing.
Do you have some sort of conquerable thing off in your distance that is unimaginably unconquerable that represents your greatest goal going forward now with with this stuff? Because I don't know how you're already testing the limits of the human reach.
Yeah, so it's hard to say. I mean, so free soloing all cap, the climb that's in the documentary Free Solo is probably going to be the most significant thing I ever climb. I mean, or if nothing else, anything that I climb in the future isn't going to have an Academy Award winning documentary made about it. So like, even if I do something that I'm more proud of, no one else is going to think it's as cool because it's not going to be portrayed in such a magnificent way. But I mean, I'm certainly working on plenty of other climbing objectives that are very hard for me. You know, I mean, there's a reason I haven't done them before. It's because they're too hard or they take too much preparation or whatever else. So, I mean, I spent the last couple months here. I live in Las Vegas. I spent the last couple months working on this traverse of a bunch of peaks near town. Though I just kind of wrote it off a couple days ago because I was like, I just don't want to do it this season. It's like too much because it's going to wind up being like a 36-hour climb or something. And it just makes me tired to think about, you know. And so, but I'll probably do something like that in the future. You know, it's like there are plenty of things to work on.
I think one of the things that made the film an award winner, I don't know if this is your opinion, I don't know how you experienced the watching of it in terms of the vulnerability and the intimacy in your personal life, but I did feel like I was watching your girlfriend trying to scale the unconquerable mountain of getting your full commitment and attention, and you were trying to climb unconquerable mountains. That's why I thought the film was great, because it just shows relationships and lives are complicated. How did you experience all that? Because that was digging deep into your vulnerabilities there, and I don't know how your girlfriend or where that relationship ended up going either. So I'm asking innocently and ignorantly how that story ended as a love story.
No, I think that's actually a good take. That I mean, your takeaway that relationships are complicated. It's like, yeah, that's totally fair. But so my girlfriend in the film is now my wife. We've been together since then. It's been great. Yeah, you know, she was with me through the whole crazy Academy Award tour and everything, and we got married last year. So it's been great. But I mean, I think that what you're saying is totally fair. The film shows us in the first 2 years of dating, basically. And so, you know, imagine being a year and a half into a relationship, which seems very promising, and, you know, your partner seems great, but, you know, you have this other goal that you've been working on, you know, that you've been dreaming about for like 10, 15 years, and you've been working on for a couple. It's like, obviously a relatively promising new relationship is going to pale in comparison to this life goal, you know, something that you know would be the achievement of your lifetime. And so I think that the tension in the film is like, oh, yeah, obviously I'm prioritizing climbing over my now wife. Because, you know, at that point, the ratios kind of made sense. But I think now, you know, we're almost 5.5, 6 years into like a great relationship and we're married. And I'm sort of like, oh, you know, the balance slowly changes over time.
So when I'm introducing you, though, I experienced it incorrectly when I say as an art form, as an Academy Award winning art form, the friends of yours who made that movie were trying to tell you, hey, she doesn't understand this thing that you love and never will.
No, I think she understands it pretty well now. I mean, you know, but that's the interesting thing with the film is that, you know, they spent 2 years filming with me. And at the beginning of the documentary process, actually, I think we had started filming before I even met Sonny, my now wife. So, you know, they have clips of us dating when it's like 4 months into a relationship and she barely climbed. So it's like, obviously she doesn't know anything about climbing at that point. But now, you know, she's been climbing 5.5 years and she's actually probably fair to say like a relatively elite climber. She's climbing at a pretty high level now. And I think she understands it pretty well. You know, I mean,
Sorry. I didn't know. I didn't think that she was somebody who wanted that life for you going forward. Or I might be, because I haven't seen the movie in a year, but I remember the feeling of she doesn't care about this the way that he does. I didn't realize that she also ended up being somebody who is an accomplished climber.
No, I think it's fair to say that she doesn't care about it the way that I care about it. She doesn't care about free soloing especially, but I think she understands that it's an important part of my life and she sort of respects the things that I care about. You know, in the same way that she has some hobbies and passions that I don't really care about, but they're part of what makes her uniquely her and I appreciate that about her. You know what I mean? It's like, I think that, you know, she loves climbing and she loves seeing me climb and everything, but she would never encourage me to go free soloing because obviously she, you know, it's dangerous. She's not gonna encourage that, but she will tolerate it / sort of support it in the sense that it's important to me.
I love that as a definition, though, tolerating it / sort of supporting it. And you're talking about life, you know, life and death consequences because of what a challenge seeker you are. I don't think anybody can understand that. Even you, maybe the fellow climbers, I guess. I guess that's who you're speaking to, right? In climbing gold, where you're trying, people who are obsessed enough about this to go into places that man usually can't.
Yeah. The thing about, I mean, in some ways, I think you're making it seem a little too extreme, because it's like really what we're talking about is managing risk in a relationship. And it's like really every relationship manages different types of risks. Like if you have a partner who consistently goes out drinking on the weekends and then drives home like slightly buzzed, it's like they're taking all kinds of unexpected risk in their life that they're not necessarily planning for. But like how many relationships have, you know, one partner who like parties harder than the other, or like does recreational drug use and like then, you know, functions sort of impaired? Kind of like those are the risks that people take all the time, but don't really consider it like life or death risk taking. I think that the difference with my relationship is that, you know, the risks seem more extreme, but I'm also taking them with a lot more preparation, a lot more, like I'm very clear eyed about it. Like I'm doing things that I want to do. I'm doing them intentionally because they matter to me. And we're having an adult conversation about it. You know what I mean? It's like everyone takes risks. It's like whether or not you're taking the ones that you choose to take and you're doing them intentionally.
Alex, thank you. Find you endlessly fascinating. I think that's part of the reason Free Solo ended up being the impactful thing that it was. 10-part podcast series, Climbing Gold, available wherever you get your podcast. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, pleasure chatting.
Thank you, Alex.
Yeah, cheers.
You want to try that again, Stugatz?
What happened? Thank you, Alex.
Stugatz struggled some there.
Got choked up.
Yep.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Score major comfort with the new Hanes Originals Super Soft Styles. Imagine this. Fabric so soft, it feels like you're practically wearing nothing. Now that's next level softness. Whether you're storming the court, conquering the workday, or just chilling on the couch, Hanes Originals Super Soft Styles have you covered, literally, in soft, cooling comfort. And let's not forget the style. These sleek designs and colors won't just keep you feeling great, they'll have you looking like a champion. So ditch the discomfort and upgrade your game with the new Hanes Originals Super Soft Styles. They're soft, they're cooling, they're everything. Try Hanes' softest fabric ever at hanes.com/originals. Use discount code DANLB20.
It is a strange thing. Just a couple of climbers.
Speaking of hell, Satan.
Talking about stuff. Isn't that what he said?
I said a couple of climbers talking about climbing. I was asking a serious question about crevices.
Have we arrived at the place in your descent where you can't get your own lazy catchphrases right?
Oh, man. I'm giving it 108%. You know, my mom died. Dad Joe, Moderna, two shots. Dad, Moderna.
Dad?
Masvidal.
Dad?
Yeah, my dad got the Moderna shot. He's not feeling very good. He's, you know, that had that going on, trying to keep him busy. You know, a lot happening. I'm descending. Yeah, bomb threat. Parking lot.
You need someone to talk to, Stu? I'm here for you if you
want. Yeah, I do, Bill.
Psychiatrist?
Yep.
Seems like not many people are concerned with all of what you're going through, you know?
I agree. Thank you. I need some time.
On his mind there.
Yep.
How'd that bomb threat impact you today?
Got my mind off the other stuff going on in my life. You know?
Did it.
Yeah.
How's the root canal going?
Oh, God. I got a doozy coming up tomorrow, Bill.
No, you don't. You have another one tomorrow?
I get crowned tomorrow. I get the permanent crown put on.
What is this, like number 18?
That's the thing. There's an issue for Stupati Records, it's a root canal or something. And I'm like, guys, the good news is Stugatz is running out of teeth. So we can't have many.
They really
more of
don't
these.
Believe Stugatz. I don't know whether you're right or not, Billy, but
he's wrong on this.
I was suckered even last week, if you are right, because I was like, man, Stugatz, I'm really sorry that you're going through that for the 40th time.
Yeah. Yeah, bad teeth. Look, Abby just sent me a text this morning. Bill, this is how much I'm going through. Fox can take you on Friday instead of next Thursday. I have to have a wisdom tooth pulled. I mean, how about that? This is unbelievable.
You see Fox? Like Fox Sports?
Like Dr. Fox, yeah. I don't know why you don't believe me, Bill. I don't lie to you.
Come
on. Just to the guest booker. I've been good about the guest booker, Bill. Have I not?
Yeah.
I mean, oh, boy.
I'm trying. Come on, Bill.
He hates being called
Jack
Bill.
Nicholas.
Please stop calling him Bill. He's mentioned it to you before. He's Billy.
I loved, by the way, hey, you Bill. Promoting Jack Nicholas Jr. by tagging Jack Nicholas.
And then just going, I after yeah, at Jack Nicholas, and then I.
The headiest of plays. I mean, come on. Come on.
You're so fraudy.
A little credit, man. The Golden Bear.
Son.
Seconds.
The Golden Bears. Done.
Golden Cub.
Yeah, the Golden Cub. That was a good interview. I liked it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I feel like I don't even need to read the book now, though. I'm like, all right, well, I got a couple of the 18 lessons. I'm
right.
good.
He gave you a few lessons and a story. You're good. Right. Are you a golfer?
I am. Not very good, but I do golf often.
Well, you'll fit right in with our crew.
Yeah, Mike and I already talked about playing around, but he said he sucks, so I'm excited to see it.
Well, he is the owner of the greatest shot in the history of golf, I will tell you that.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
It was a par 3, 11th hole, Parkland Golf and Country Club. 130 yards from the white tees. Mike took out the driver, of course, and I asked Mike what he was doing, and he said, Stu, boomstick. And so
he hit a driver 100 from a tee 130 yards on a par 3.
Wait, it gets better.
Yes. Now here's the thing.
Does it get better?
Mike said, Stu, I got it. Don't worry. Now Mike and I are on the same team. I'm a little concerned. Driver 120 yards. If Mike gets a hold of it, that thing can go 300 yards. Mike's a strong kid. He's a young man. But Mike hit the greatest golf shot in the history of golf.
You mentioned that.
He stuck a driver 119 yards. Okay. It landed 1 foot 10 inches from the cup. He tapped in for birdie. We won the hole. What? Greatest
shot
in history. Yeah, for real.
That's how bad you are at golf that you can use the complete wrong club, but you're hitting it so poorly that it ends up working out for you. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Okay,
and that's
things.
Only the first time that he's told you this story.
Well, just two things. One of them is just Stugatz getting the math wrong on his whole story.
Now
which
my
is
incredible
amazing.
Shot at the Devil's Island.
It's gotten less.
Less
good.
Impressive because it's gotten further away. You added a foot to my shot.
Was I at 11 inches? Well, oh, that's right. I had 11 more times to tell the story.
I think 10 inches from the cup, we gave him the shot. I'm pretty sure that you had it about 11 feet from the cup because I think you had it 130 foot hole and you put it a 119. So you put it like you've called.
I said 120 from the whites.
He gave me the roll, I guess.
Yeah.
But Jessica's right on there. The only club that I was hitting well
just
that day
a couple
was a driver.
Just a couple of golfers talking about golf.
Yeah.
Boomstick. I'm excited to get down to South Florida, pull out the clubs, get to use them a little bit more.
Well, that's another thing that you need to know right now. Stugatz is never going to actually golf with you.
Yeah, probably.
That's right.
That's
he'll make plenty of golfing.
Fine.
Yeah.
In fact, I had Charlie Hume, an old producer of ours. He came all the way up to my house thinking he was going to play golf with me, and I canceled when he was on the driving range.
Stugatz hid from him the entire time. Billy, you seem to be really lashing out. You seem to be particularly angry today about Stugatz's lies for some reason.
No. I just feel like I'm giving an accurate onboarding, which is what we need today.
On
just,
what she's dealing with in terms of
yeah,
who
just
Stugatz
know
is?
Like he'll invite you over. You'll drive 90 minutes north. It's super far from here. And then once you get there, he'll just have disappeared. And then he'll pretend like, oh, buddy, I had a this or I had a that or another root canal or this or that. So just be very careful.
Jesse in town next week?
I think 2 weeks from now.
All right, 18 holes, my house. All right.
Oh boy.
See you there, maybe.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite.
You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.